From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's how tree expert Nalini Nadkarni explains the relationship between humans and trees. We are in-laws, sort of. We're not of the same family, she says, but in a sense, trees and humans are married into each other's families. Our ancestors, she says, evolved along with trees. And in her book, she explains that our grasping hands and our opposable thumbs helped us leap between branches in the tree-studded savannas of our prehistoric landscape. Today in the program, we're talking about trees, about our affinity with trees. Nadkarni will explain the connection, which she says is more than just about shelter and protection. Trees give us health and symbolism, peace and play. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you're just thinking in practical terms, it's easy to make the case for the value of trees. Think shelter, think fire, think of the carbon dioxide they store, the oxygen they produce, the soil they protect, the species they support. But the biologist and researcher Nalini Nadkarni says trees also provide less tangible values. They've played an important part in symbolism, a role in art, in language, in spirituality even. And Nadkarni says we're connected to trees because we evolved alongside them. So we can trace many of our impulses and our behaviors back to our very earliest ancestors who made their homes, of course, in trees. Today in the program, Nadkarni is joining us to talk about the remarkable relationship between humans and trees. Nalini Nadkarni is a biology professor at the University of Utah. Nalini Nadkarni, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. I'm so thrilled to be here.
So I want to begin with your mom.
My mom.
Yeah, in this way, because there's this reference you make in your book, in the acknowledgments, and you say your mother encouraged you to climb tall trees.
She did. My mother, Goldie Nadkarni, who's now 91 years old.
Wow.
And still living on her own in Rockville, Maryland, which is wonderful. I think I the reason why I put her in that very important acknowledgement is because I am filled myself with, as a mother now, with wonder that she let me and, in fact, encouraged me to climb trees. Big, tall ones.
Yeah.
And it's more amazing because she herself is a terminal acrophobe.
Wow.
I mean, the big joke was my mom could not get up on a stepladder greater than three steps. So for her to allow me to wave hello to me when I got back from school and then I would go up one of our eight trees in the front driveway and do that, although she did admit that she would just go back into the house and not watch as I climbed trees, was really, I think, a testament to her understanding of the importance and value, even at the young age of me, of getting up into those trees and just that being my place.
Because she knew that you were – I mean, part of it is she had the foresight to be able to say, this is a great place for her to play. But she also understood your connection to trees?
I don't know if she understood it. Maybe I think because, you know, she herself would have been so filled with fear, I don't think that could have gotten into it.
Yeah.
But in retrospect, as I look back on it, I think she must have acknowledged in some way or another, not through my expressing it, but in some way that when I went out to climb trees after school, it was an important place for me. It was a place where I found peace. I found my own place. I had two brothers, two sisters, dogs, cats, homework, chores. You know, my family was a pretty chaotic, although wonderful, but still chaotic place. And
yeah.
So for me, since I was really the only member of my family who climbed trees, it became the top of those maple trees became my places. And it must have been reflected somehow to my mom that that was important to me.
So, I have a lovely image in my mind of your father trimming the trees because you write about how he did it so, it seems like, so tenderly.
Yes, that's right. And one of the my dad was a gardener. He was actually a pharmacologist, a scientist at the National Institutes of Health for his career. But to him, his garden was very important. And the trees that he planted and the vegetables and roses that he planted were very important to him. And of course, in our sort of quasi-Indian household, all the kids had chores and we had to do certain things. And one of the chores was going out and helping my dad in the garden. And I remember that he had certain ways, almost ritualistic ways of doing transplants. And he would take a rose bush from one part of the garden and plant it somewhere else. And there was a way to do it, a depth we had to dig to, the way we patted the earth around, the way we always had to water it immediately after we planted it. And it was only later, in retrospect, as I thought about where my dad came from, India, and when he came later in his life for graduate school, and how he ended up in the United States transplanted, that I became sort of understanding of this connection he had to transplanting trees, because he himself was a transplant of sorts. And so the care that I think he took with the transplanting was perhaps a wish, a desire, a need to be transplanted gently and carefully and mindfully himself. Mm.
You write about how he would, when he would trim the trees, he would coat them as if healing a wound.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we had various fruit trees in our yard, and we would, you know, he would chop down the, you know, cut off a limb to trim them, to shape them, and so forth. And he always had a can of tree paint, and there was this sort of black goopy stuff that he would put on it. And actually, in retrospect now, what arborists know about trees is that actually isn't such a great practice, that trees have the capability in some ways of blocking off and healing themselves, so to speak, if the wound isn't too large. But again, I think it was my dad's effort to care for these living things that I modeled, I think, as a child, to see someone who was not trained in arboriculture or in gardening even, but who had a sense of connection to the trees in our yard and wanted to care for them.
There are a lot of practical reasons that you wrote this book, which we'll get into, the role of trees in world ecology, those kinds of things. But really, you point out that when it comes right down to it, you wrote it because you have this love for trees.
Yes, I do have a love for trees. And, you know, as a scientist and as a, you know, a member of the faculty of the amazing University of Utah, where we – and as we scientists are taught, is you make a division between what you study and what you care for, because you need to be objective if you're going to produce objective results. And I certainly understand and applaud that system, and I've been a part of it for the last 30 years. But I also have actually – in part because of the writing of the book, in which I gave myself permission to express the emotions I have about trees, the connections I feel for trees, in addition to the knowledge I have and the data I've collected and the scientific papers I wrote. Writing this book for the University of California Press, sort of the trade side of the press, allowed me to pry off some of that overlying pushing down on admitting one's love for one's study organism. And of course, many scientists love their organisms and care for them, and that's one of the impetuses that they have for studying it. Other scientists don't particularly. My husband Jack, for example, Jack Longinot, is a biologist at the University of Utah, and he studies ants. He's an entomologist. He's loved bugs ever since he was little, and he especially loved praying mantises. He thought they were the coolest things.
Right.
But he deliberately decided not to study praying mantises because he didn't want to kill all of them.
Wow.
You know, to study them and put them on pins and everything. But he said, you know, ants, who cares? There are lots of them. I don't really have a particular affinity for ants. And so he's gotten thousands and thousands and thousands of little ants pinned and safe and under scientific scrutiny in his lab. So scientists, I think many foster a love for what they study. Others choose not to or don't. But for
you
me,
just cop to it.
I cop to trees ever since I was a kid. And so that's really what this book is about. In some ways, it's kind of a love story to trees. It's an explanation of why I care about trees, why I think others should. And that emotion of love is definitely woven into this book.
Yeah. There's a terrific story you tell early in the book of this, I guess it was an experiment. You wanted to learn how people who had never seen trees would encounter them, how they would perceive them, how they might value them. This was an idea you said you had when you were actually climbing a mountain, Mount Rainier.
Right, yes, a very tall mountain for me.
Right. And so what was the idea? What were you thinking? We'll talk about the experiment in a minute, but what got you thinking about, hey, I want to know how people who didn't live with them would maybe relate to them?
Yes. I think it really stemmed from this desire of mine to know trees in as many ways as I can. Yeah. If I can better understand them through the lenses of many different approaches and people, I will know more about trees and I'll be able to care for them better. And when I, you know, I hang out with forest ecologists all the time. We have the same vocabulary, the same background. We name trees in the same way. We have a common way of understanding them, of approaches to study them. And I began thinking that maybe it would be useful to bring someone whose experience is entirely new to trees and ask them, how do you see a tree? Do you see it as a series of leaves that are connected to twigs, that are connected to branches, that are connected to a trunk the way I do? Because I've learned that terminology and that way of seeing a tree. And so the idea of this came to me was when I was climbing Mount Rainier, a very hard climb, you know, 14,500 feet. I was having a hard time. And to amuse myself along the way to make the time pass, I began looking at the snow. And sort of, well, there's popcorn snow and there's slaty snow and there's grayish snow. And it struck me that I wondered whether I would have the same categorization of snow that an Inuit might, or a snow expert might, or somebody who really knows something about snow. And that gave me this launch pad to leap into thinking, oh my gosh, what if I brought a true novice to look at trees the way I'm a true novice looking at snow? And so I set up a number of what I call canopy confluences, where I bring I invite some forest ecologists with me to a remote place. We stay there for a week, but I also invite artists, musicians, poets, creative writers, school teachers, loggers, and we spend that week together, forest ecologists and all these other people, and we climb trees, we have platforms up in trees, and we take in what we see in the tops of trees, and then we express what we want using whatever tools it is. It might be a picture, it might be a sculpture, it might be a poem. And in one of these canopy confluences, I thought, why don't I invite a couple of Inuits who have really never seen trees in their lives, and we can get an idea of what is it like to see a tree for the first time. And so we just Googled Inuit on the web.
Is that
and
right?
We actually came up with this wonderful guy named Emil Arulak, yeah. Who lives up in Arviat in Nunavut in the northwest, what was previously the Northwest Territory, who lived in tundra. And yeah. We got him an airplane ticket.
And no
his
trees.
Pal. No trees. In fact, in the Inuit language, when Brian, the other Inuit that came down with Emil, came down, we said, first question, so how many words do you have for snow? They talked a little back and forth, and they said, 26 words. I said, how many words do you have for tree? And they looked at each other, and they paused, and Emil said, well, we use the word nabaktuk for tree, which means pole. And then Brian's, I said, what about forest? And they said, Nabaktuk Juit, which means many poles. So here, you know, we just sort of established the baseline that this is a culture, this is a language, this is a people that don't have experience with trees. So we brought them out to
because
our canopy.
Because pole has no kind of romance to it. No, really.
No, because I think they're sort of going, it's just like snow for them. If I called it just snow, it'd be like, well, that's really pathetic. you know, it's a much more rich than that.
Yeah.
So it was really the equivalent of not having a connection to trees, culturally and ethnically. But we brought them out with us for a week. We taught them how to climb using our mountain climbing techniques. They sat on platforms. It was very scary for them, not just the tree, but the being high, because they don't really have anything that's high in the very flat tundra. But they slept out. They camped out with us underneath the shade of a cedar tree, a western red cedar tree, which is actually the tree that's most sacred to the Native Americans of that area. And they sort of found that tree. That's where they ended up being. And at the end of the week, we're sitting around.
They naturally gravitated to that.
They
tree?
Did. They just said, "This is the tree we like." So that we all sort of looked at that and thought, "That's really cool."
Yeah.
But at the end of the session of the week, we were all going around the campfire as we did every night, sort of saying, "What are you taking away from this?" And Emil said, in his, you know, this wonderful Inuit accent, said, "Well, we didn't know about trees when we first got here, but now that we have spent this week with you and with other people who see that trees are important, we see that you should be treating your trees like we treat our elders, that they are your guideposts, the way the cairns of stones are on our pathways through the tundra." And the whole group around this campfire, the 20 people who were there, just went silent. Because those words, of course, coming from someone like me, a conservationist, would be like so ordinary. But coming from a man who really had never seen a tree before that week, who had never spent time, who had never really had an experiential understanding of what pine cones smell like and, you know, all the kinds of things we make out of trees and what shade means on a hot day. He, in that very short week, had come to understand that these poles that he had called them, these many poles, was in fact such a valuable ecosystem component as valuable as the input of their elders. And that was very touching and very moving to me, because it meant then that it's not just people who are always around trees and have a knowledge of trees that value them, but there must be something very elementally deep in the human spirit that connects with trees when we find them, when we encounter them, even if it's only a week-long period. So that was quite deep for me.
Mm. You know, you talk about, and I want to actually spend a little bit more time a little bit later in the program talking about the art that you've encountered that has been inspired by some of these confluences. Dance and sculpture. There's some amazing stuff. But this intersection for you between art, performance, dance, really, you're a dancer, and science, I wanted to ask you about, because you write about how you, of course, you studied dance when you were young. You mentioned this in the book. From a teacher who taught you a lot about what you call aesthetic action. Talk a little bit about that, because it seems to have had an influence on the way you – that aesthetic seems to have had an influence on the way you conduct science, even as a researcher. Is that
right? Yes, that's true. So I had this wonderful modern dance teacher. My two sisters and I took modern dance. Her name was Erica Timai, and she emphasized that everyone is a dancer. You don't have a skinny body. You can just dance. But she also believed in discipline. But she treated dance as an intellectual exercise as well as a physical one. And so I grew up understanding that aesthetics and thinking, dance and science or the intellectual can go side by side, and in fact, they are better when they are together. So I think I had a sense of the importance of beauty, but also the importance of linking the thinking that goes along with beauty, and that those two can be together. So that has persisted in my life, not only in terms of I think dance is beautiful and wonderful, and I've made partnerships with dancers in order to communicate science, but also that we can blend – there are times we can blend science and art together in ways that are really – that actually excite the scientific parts of our brains. For example, I worked at the Evergreen State College, which is very much about interdisciplinary learning and teaching. There are no grades, there are no departments, but and so when you go to the photocopy machine, you might be standing next to a philosopher or a French teacher or whatever. So one day I was the scientist standing next to a computer musician, Arun Chandra, and we were photocopying stuff, and he said, "What are those data?" And I said, "Well, these are retranslocation data. They're the how plants, trees can actually pull out nitrogen from their leaves before they fall, and that's a nutrient conservation mechanism," which is really incredible
in
itself.
We should talk
about that. But he said, "Well, look at this graph. This graph is just numbers, right?" And I said, "Well, yes, that's what data are in science." And he said, "Well, music is just numbers too." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, music is just the frequencies of you. You can take any group of numbers, and if you make them frequencies, you can then create a piece of music." He said, "Hand me your data." So I did. I handed him my data, and he said, "I'll be back to you next week." And he created this amazing computer music that was just a transcription of my nutrient retranslocation data. And so it was a partnership that allowed us to think about, wow, what if there were a blind person that wanted to get an understanding of nutrient retranslocation? So he's presented papers at his computer music conferences, and I've talked about this at my ecology conferences. It's really data sonification, and I think it has an application. But it's an example of how if a scientist and a computer musician are open-minded and understand that there's if not an equality, at least a parity in terms of saying that music can deal with science or intellectual stuff and science can deal with aesthetic stuff, then sometimes what emerges is something that is unexpected and perhaps useful in terms of understanding our world. And so I've tried to take that concept over and over again to bring science to musicians, to poems, to poets, to slam poets, to tattoo artists, to modern dancers, not just to have them say, here's my understanding of the forest. Now you translate it to people who like poetry or people who love modern dance. I use it for that. But I also love to do that because sometimes I get an insight from a modern dancer about my work or about the forest ecosystem that I wouldn't otherwise have gotten. And that's, to me, super duper exciting.
Nalini Nadkarni is with us. Her book is called Between Earth and Sky. We need to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking about the relationship between humans and trees. The smart and charismatic tree expert, Nalini Nadkarni, is with us. She is living in Utah these days, joining us to talk about our natural affinity with trees. So I think there was a point when you were thinking, okay, do I follow dance and art or do I follow science? You picked the science part.
Yes.
But in some ways you figured, I guess probably, I don't really need to just discard one. I can make both of them work in my career. Is that right?
Actually, when I discarded the one, modern dance.
Yeah.
So I had taken modern dance lessons my whole childhood. I did modern dance and biology at Brown University where I was an undergraduate. And it was really after I graduated that I said, okay, I don't think I can be allowed to do both of these. You know, science requires this like full-time commitment to the lab and modern dance, you know, requires this full-time commitment to the body. And so I realized that I would have to make a choice. So I thought I should try them both out before I made my decision. So I found this researcher in Papua New Guinea, a remote sort of field station in New Guinea in the middle of the South Pacific. And I said I'd be his assistant. You know, I wouldn't need any money. I just wanted to apprentice with him. And he invited me to go ahead and I spent a year with him. And then it was time to try modern dance. So I traveled to Paris, France, and I joined up with a modern dance studio, Danse Paris, for 6 months. And then after that, I sat down with all my journals and notebooks and read them through at a cafe. We went with like 18 cups of tea. And I decided to go into science because I felt the questions that were being asked in science were more appealing and compelling to me. I could help the earth more. I would have a longer career, like the guy I worked for was 70 years old, whereas the dancers were sort of no more career after age 30, you know, in terms of performance. And I loved living in the rainforest. I loved living with wild things instead of living in a city, as is necessary if you're a modern dancer. So, you know, when I slapped my journal shut, I said, okay, it's going to be graduate school for forest ecology. And that's what I did. And I really, in my mind, I thought, that's it for modern dance. I can go watch performances. You know, I might take a class now and then, but that was it. Until just 4 years ago, and I got this amazing phone call from a modern dancer named Jody Lomask. And she said, Dr. Nadkarni, I want to make a dance about rainforest. Would you help me? And I said, yes, I would. I would. And so we got together and had this fantastic collaboration, which continues today.
Biome?
This is Biome. This is the dance called Biome. And I started by taking her up into one of our canopy confluences in the Northwest. She said, this is fantastic, but I want to go down to the tropical rainforest. So we brought all her and all of her troupe, seven more dancers down to Costa Rica, climbed trees in my plot. I told her about vines and frogs and soils and trees. And, you know, after 3 days, they had their clothes off and were dancing naked in the rainforest. But when they went back to San Francisco, they made this dance called Biome. And we performed it in a way that was very, I think, very useful. I started out with a 10-minute talk about the science of the rainforest, its fragility, its diversity, its importance. And then this 90-minute dance of Jody and Biome and her dancers, which was very emotional and very inspirational. And then we had in the lobby, we had tables of run by conservation groups that offered sort of local conservation opportunities. So what we hoped was then that the science and the education that I provided, along with the inspiration and emotional connection of the dance, would lead then to prompt people to say, I want to do something about rainforest. I want to do something about the earth. And so for me, it was like a circle coming back around again. And I was so happy to sort of re-find a part of myself, which was the dancer. And I think Jody, in her dance circles, is truly an intellectually brilliant person. And so her conversations and understanding about the complex adaptations, evolutionary biology, interactions of forest things was for her something that enriched and deepened her dance. And so I think it's a model that other scientists and other artists can follow to great effect.
When we climb a tree, we get up into a tree, which a lot of us did as kids, still do maybe. There's something that you've written about a kind of familiarity up there. What is that? Is that a biological impulse that we're feeling some sort of remnant sense of comfort from our evolutionary past?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I, of course, can't prove anything. It's very difficult to prove evolutionary origins of behaviors and structures and so forth. But my sense, having taught, well, first of all, myself climbing, and I know the sense I have when I'm in a treetop and how safe, how protected I feel, even though I'm 200 feet above the forest floor, And all of the many, many people, I've probably taught 1,000 people how to climb using my rope techniques to get up into canopies, from little kids to old people. And what I see in almost all of the most acrophobic is that there's a sense of relaxation into it, a sense of, I belong here, I fit here, this is my place, I can see far. And I think that might be sort of a consequence of the fact that we did evolve in trees in a savanna setting in Africa, this big wide swatches of savanna, but these widely spaced umbrella-like tree crowns where when we climbed them, we were safe from the predators. And so I see that in human form when I think about, you know, the Space Needle in Seattle, Washington. People pay like $7 for a cup of coffee to go into the Seattle Space Needle because they can see far and it turns around. Or they can see the whole landscape. And that makes perfect evolution. And, you know, penthouses, if you rent a penthouse apartment, you're going to pay a premium for it because you get that beautiful, wonderful view that, in fact, might make you feel safer because you can see the predators that might be coming toward you from that high level. So all of those things combined, as well as a sense of just fun, a sense of challenge, a sense of risk, which we often welcome in our otherwise sedentary lives, all of those things, I think, accompany you as you move higher and higher into a tree crown. And as you take one branch after another or one more hitch up your Jumar ascender, as you leave the earth, you find yourself in this different world in which you belong.
You wrote a manual, a guide to climbing trees. How old were you when you did that?
Oh, gosh. This was, I guess I'd have to count it as my first publication, but it was not a peer-reviewed article, I can tell you. It was a little staple-together booklet that was entitled Be Among the Birds. And it was a child's guide to tree climbing. And in it, I described with illustrations how you move, like if your tree is split into two trunks, how you make that move from one trunk to another, how you ensure safety, which of the 8 trees along my parents' driveway were the most amenable to climbing or not. There was one copy. I'd give anything to see that copy right now, but I guess it was a precursor of the kinds of things that I'm doing now, which is to try to engage people with trees and tree climbing.
I love the idea that you write this guide, and I guess there is a technique to it, right? I mean, there is a way of – so when you first encounter a tree – now I know it's different if you're trying to get up into a really, really big tree. I'm sure there's a giant strangler fig, for example. Mm-hmm. There's a technique there, obviously. But I guess you sort of have to break it down, right, and look at you have to really consider
it. Well, there are many ways to climb trees, of course. One of them is the old childhood way of just grabbing a branch and moving up. But now people like myself who study forest canopies have developed this range of techniques to get up into trees. And the one that I use most frequently involves basically using modified mountain climbing techniques. So we treat the tree as if it were a mountain. The only thing that's different is we have to get the line up one of the branches first. And so I've invented this thing called a master caster, which is a steel rod with a fishing reel mounted on the bottom to hold the string, the fishing cord, and then a very powerful slingshot mounted on the top.
Wow.
So you look around, you stand at the tree that you're going to climb, you walk around it to find exactly the right shot to get to the right branch that you want to get to, and then you take this, you have a 2-ounce weight on the end of your fishing line, and you shoot it up with the slingshot. It comes down, hopefully. Sometimes you have to sort of twing it down. Then you tie a parachute cord, which is like a quarter-inch nylon cord. You reel that up and over the branch, and then you can tie a regular mountain climbing rope to the end of that parachute cord, pull that up and over, tie that up, one end of that off. You get into a harness that you get at REI, just a standard mountain climbing harness, and these ascenders that can go up the rope. And it's a matter then of just sort of walking up the rope, essentially. It's non-destructive. It doesn't hurt the tree because it's just one line that's up and down. It's very safe, knock on wood. there's another use of trees. It doesn't – you know, we've had a very, very safe climbing record. We've had no accidents at all in the 35 years of climbing I've done. So it's a fabulous way to get to certain parts of the tree. You can't get out to the very top or the very edges. But there are other techniques for that. Forest canopy researchers are using construction cranes, installing them in forests. They're using walkways, even hot air balloons. There's a French group that's using hot air balloons to transport sort of a web work that can be lowered gently onto the canopies of large trees in windless areas. So this idea of getting up into trees over the last 20 years, I'd say, has been largely overcome. And really, anybody can get up into the forest canopy, and everybody should. But when I first started out doing this, the getting up into the canopy was a real challenge. And I have to say, you know, I love the science I'm doing in the canopy. I love the questions I'm asking and answering. But part of the joy of my research is just the physical aesthetic act of figuring out which branch I'm going to get in, getting it over the line, getting it over the branch, and then climbing up and sitting there.
There's this interesting part of your book where you mention Abraham Maslow and his hierarchy of needs. And then you're trying to sort of fit where trees go into that hierarchy. And so you sort of crafted your own hierarchy of needs and how trees fit into that. I wanted you to go through that, if you would.
Sure. So there's this, you know, this great concept of the what motivates humans to do stuff.
Yeah.
And we need to have our certain needs met. And the sort of the bottom need that we need met are physical needs like food and air and water. And then after that, you get sort of security needs, housing. After that, you get your social needs met. You know, you have to have people like you and care for you. Then you have to have your ego needs met. And that's about, you know, have I done a good job in my life?
Yeah.
And that all leads you to a place where you can be self-actualized. You can actually sort of enjoy life and be fulfilled. So I thought, wow, that's a really great way of looking at life and what humans need. And my thesis has always been that trees are inextricably entwined with the needs of human beings. So I thought, so how do I sort of adapt Maslow's triangle to trees? So I set up a slightly taller pyramid of needs, starting with the physical needs that trees provide for us. And certainly they do. Apples that we eat, shade trees for coffee that we drink, and air that we breathe. They, you know, create oxygen and so forth. They certainly, and my next level was security and health needs. And that's where I think about trees that are derived from, or medicines that are derived from trees. So we got quinine from tree bark. Mm-hmm. You know, we have all kinds of cancer compounds, anti-cancer compounds. Taxol, for example, has been the most incredible new anti-cancer compound that's been developed. Needs for play. We need play and imagination. So baseball bats, you know, they're made out of wood. The Louisville sluggers are made out of ash and maple trees. Basketball floors, those are made out of sugar maple. So they definitely, you know, help us. They fill the need for play. Time and the awareness of time of our lives is very important. And trees, I think, are great indicators of time because their generations are much longer than ours. And so when we plant trees in cemeteries, it reminds us that although we have buried our loved ones, there's still a sense of connection to living because these trees are there.
See, all of those things, a lot of those things anyway, are related to the symbolic value of a tree. I mean, a tree is this kind of living symbol, this living metaphor, I guess.
And, you know, when I started looking into this, I realized, whoa, how do we use trees as symbols? And so you start looking at logos of companies that want to brand themselves. Well, look at the DoubleTree hotel chain, for example. You know, they want to identify themselves as something that's sort of wholesome and sustainable and clean and a place you want to come home to. And so they chose, you know, these two trees as their logo. And there are now many, many companies that use logos. There's 60 countries that use them on their currency and their coins. So when you think about a dollar bill, we want to represent ourselves. So what do we choose to put on our currency? Well, many of them are trees. And I think that's another sort of interesting way to look at symbols. And then spirituality is meets so many needs, or trees meet so many needs or provide so many connections between humans and their own spiritual choices, their spiritual communications, their ways of living, because they present symbols like the tree of life, which is a almost universal symbol. Actually, it precedes the Bible when the Celts and many other cultures thought about what is the universe. And they had a tree, Yggdrasil, which was the center of the universe that connected the lower part of the earth with Midgard, the middle part of the earth, and Asgard, which was the upper part. And it was the tree, really, that was the connector. So it presaged, I think, really this connection between trees and spirituality for humans.
You write about your own sense of spirituality in the book. Your father was Hindu. Your mother was Jewish. You ended up going to Unitarian Sunday school.
Right.
So you guys are all over the map. And you did this investigation in, I think it was 2001, you write about, where you explored those connections between trees and the spirituality in places of worship. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, I guess this is what you're – I mean, I'm thinking of I guess the cross is an image. I'm not sure if it's related to spirituality, but there it is, right?
Right. Yeah, sure. In Russian, the word for the cross is the tree. And in fact, sometimes Christians do refer to the cross as a tree. Jesus was a carpenter, you know, so there's another connection.
Yeah,
so this connection between trees and spirituality is something I really wanted actively to pursue, almost in an academic way. And the impetus was that because there are so many people who are religious and are spiritual in our species, and about 80% of the people you ask or have been asked say, yes, I'm a religious person. So that's a lot of people. So if I could connect trees to the value, the sort of the ecological values of trees that I know about as a scientist with the religious and spiritual values of all these people who might not necessarily care that much about ecological values, then I'd have a way to sort of move into it. So I just started by reading the Bible, reading the holy scriptures of the world's major religions and looking for the words tree and forest and thinking, if I can find these verses and how they describe trees, I'll have a clue as to how they're valued within these different world religions. Well, after a while, after reading some, I then actually downloaded the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Quran, and the Talmud from the web and just did a search for the words tree and forest. And I found that there were 328 references, for example, in the Old Testament alone. And I sort of categorized those into different categories like practical use, like eating apples, or, ornamentation of temples, analogies to God, beautification of, location descriptions and so forth. And then I collected the same information from all of, the Hindu Gita, the Talmud, the Quran, and I just found these references and I sort of pulled them together. And then I decided it would be time to give a sermon about this, about trees and spirituality and places of worship. Because if the people who go to that church or that synagogue or temple believe in their own holy scriptures and I provide evidence from their holy scriptures, it seems like there would be no argument, and that would be a different approach than saying, hey, I can tell you about carbon and climate change and nitrogen cycling, and that's why trees are important. So I spent about 2 months just first looking at the – on Saturdays looking for when the different churches had their worship times, and I would pick a church each Sunday and then just sit in the back pew and listen because I really didn't know what goes on in churches because of my weird religious background.
Yeah.
And after about 2 months of listening, I felt I was ready then to approach the pastor or the clergyman or the rabbi and say, might I offer a trees and spirituality lecture?
That's so great.
And of course, it's the first one who said yes was the Unitarian minister in Olympia, Washington, and that was my sort of – and then once I gave the sermon there and it was met with great enthusiasm and great interest and people would raise their hand and say, we sing a hymn about trees and you forgot about that.
Yeah.
Then I was passed on to Presbyterians and Baptists and Episcopalians and Jews and other, other faiths. So it was really about putting aside for the moment my scientific arguments and values and saying I'm going to immerse myself in your values in order to be effective in talking about trees. And after that, and after some of the sermons, a number of people would come up and say, tell me more about forest, tell me more about climate change, tell me more. In fact, there was a Baptist – I spoke to the Baptist church and one of the men came up to me afterward and said, Dr. Nadkarni, could I get your email address? And I went like, oh, no, this is going to be the – they're going to recruit me. I said, I'm a Hindu Jew, okay? I'm not going to become a Baptist, I don't think. Don't bother. He said, oh, no, this isn't about that. This is that we plant trees once a month in our churches. We have a church group to do tree planting. And we thought you and your students might be interested in joining us. And I just had to, felt shame that, I don't have a student group that plants trees, but these guys do. Why? Because they see trees as part of, God's creation.
Yeah.
And they have a will, a desire, and a need to help protect all of God's creation. So my own misconceptions about what a Baptist might be approaching me for got all turned around. And I realized that, with renewed respect, that when we scientists place ourselves in the venues of the people to whom we're supposedly giving information, we in fact learn a lot.
This is interesting. Maybe it's a brief little diversion here, but you write about the importance of sacred groves in spirituality. Mm-hmm. Mormons have a very important story that played out in a sacred grove where Joseph Smith says he saw God. But sacred groves, I didn't realize that was kind of a motif.
It's a motif, and I'll tell you from my own Indian background that sacred groves are some of the most important foci for conservation because it was in these groves where the Hindu you know, these spirits lived. And so the 13,270 sacred groves that now exist in India are really where the only places where you find certain rare trees and protected trees because of that religious sense that we need to protect these. The Druids, you know, in early England, they were the ones who thought trees were, you know, well, the word Druid comes from the same word as tree, Deru, which means strong and enduring. And so Druids were protectors of trees, carers and stewards of trees, and that was sort of their basis. Mm. And the trees that they planted were the sites where then the Christians decided to put their early churches because they sort of drew the strength from that spiritual tradition that existed before them. And so sacred groves are very important. And one of the things I've done here actually in Salt Lake City is to offer the services of myself and my students to map trees in some of our churchyards in St. Mark's Cathedral, Episcopal Cathedral downtown, also the Unitarian Church here on right near the university. And so we go in and we actually map the trees, you know, and we then make a little pamphlet that has a description and we name the trees. We give them identifications of their biological name and we provide information about their biology and ecology, but also about, you know, if there's a spiritual reference, like a locust tree, which is a very common street tree here. Well, the locust tree is what St. John the Baptist survived on when he went out into the desert, you know, locust and honey. And so a congregation member gets that little booklet and goes, my gosh, we're protecting some really important trees. And if you want to protect them on the sacred ground of your church, well, maybe you'll think about protecting them in your backyard or the shopping center. Or how about the Wasatch Mountains, the seven canyons that make our water here? Or how about the state of Utah? So by starting with something that is already sacred to that congregation person, then you branch out from that, so to speak, yeah, to encompass the sacredness, literally, of the trees and other living things that live with us in this amazing environment.
You know, there's this image which offers a kind of counter perspective to well, the image of Gustave Doré's image of the cedars of Lebanon tearing down these big, massive cedars to build a temple, which is sort of the counter, which is not so appealing as an idea. But you talked about the fact that those – I'm not sure how historical that idea is, but those groves of cedars, they have still not recovered, I guess.
Right.
Is that right?
I mean, that's true. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the lessons that we can take from whether they're apocryphal true or not. You know, we can argue about that. But I think that's one of the things that what I mentioned earlier is that this idea of time, this idea of human lifetimes being 70, 80 years, and the lifetime of something like a cedar could be 1,000 or 1,500 years. And so humans who operate in their sphere of 60, 70, 80 years, I think we have a very hard time to stretch it into what is a lifetime, both in terms of growth and also especially recovery, that when we do bulldoze down some trees that are very old, how do we come to replace those trees? But even more complexly, how do we replace the forest that those trees occur in, the animals, the plants, the microorganisms, the soil that might have been destroyed in a fire or a human interaction? So that's one of the things I love about being with trees and forests is it forces me to think outside my own timeline and it lengthens it. You know, I really feel sorry for microbiologists because, you know, the lifetime of their little protozoan is like so tiny and goes around and around so fast. But maybe they get a different, you know, perspective on time that I don't have. And it's really funny how, you know, there's a wonderful poem by Gary Snyder where he talks about how to the rocks, the trees are just moving through.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's such a beautiful way to think about this playing with time that we have, and by getting to know trees, by watching them grow, and they grow very slowly from our perspective. But if you live in Utah, you live in the avenues, you live anywhere where there's some urban trees that you see day after day, year after year, you know that they change. And I think that's one of the reasons why people do not automatically think that trees are connected to them, because they don't see them change. They see them as immobile. They see them as silent. They see them as insentient. They see them as not moving, and therefore we don't have to worry about them because they're not screaming at us or running away. And I think we have to sort of shift our way of thinking that, in fact, they are dynamic and they do move and they, you know, they have needs that, in fact, require us to think about their length of time instead of casually thinking, oh, this will just come back.
Biologist and tree expert Nalini Nadkarni is with us. Her book is called Between Earth and Sky, Our Intimate Connections to Trees. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Nalini Nadkarni. She's a biology professor at the University of Utah, author of the book Between the Earth and Sky, Our Intimate Connections to Trees. One of the things you write about in the book is trees and health. And it's extraordinary. All of the prescription drugs that come from trees come from living creatures. But just in the interest of time, because we don't have a lot of time, you also write about trees and their connection to emotional health.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you about that. One of the things you explored a little bit is how tree imagery reduces stress in hospital patients.
Right.
Just the idea of seeing what images of trees, mm-hmm. the connection to it can calm us down?
Yeah, you know, again, this is, it pretty much fits when people know when they walk through the, most people know that when they walk through the forest, they feel like, I feel better, I feel calmer. Well, back in the early 1990s, there was a behavioral psychologist named Roger Ulrich who decided to try to apply that to the world of hospitals. Hospitals tend to be very blank, ugly places with no paint, no imagery, or no nature at all, because that's the way hospitals are. And he did a study, kind of a retrospective study, on patients that were treated for the same disease, gallbladder removal, in rooms that either had a tree facing out so that a patient could see these trees, or just a concrete wall.
Yeah.
And he collected the records for 6 years, and he compared the two, and they were the same, in, you know, same doctors, same operations, same nurses, and so forth. And what he found was that those patients who had the view of a real tree out the window had fewer days of recovery, used fewer painkillers, had fewer nurse complaints, and fewer sort of post-operative complications. And so it wasn't just that they felt better, they actually recovered faster. And so this idea, that was really a landmark study, but what it has led to is a very widespread understanding that, in fact, the presence of nature can really calm people down and bring a sense of, if not direct healing, at least get a sense of feeling better. And so many hospitals now are actually, since they don't have trees out the window, they're not lucky enough to have that, they're actually buying backlit windows that they can put in from companies like, there's one called Sky Factory, and there are these images of trees and sky. And so just before you go into that, you know, that sort of horrible next, you know, operation or to go into some sort of testing, if you see these images of trees and skies, it actually brings down stress levels enough to warrant the cost that the hospital has paid.
Mm.
So now I'm trying to use that idea to work with prisoners in solitary confinement, which is really the most nature deficit habitat you can even, you know, imagine.
Yeah.
And so we have permission to work in an Oregon prison that has solitary confinement inmates. And so we're showing videos. We can't bring in trees, obviously. We can't bring in frogs or any living thing, but we can show these videos in their exercise rooms. So the early sort of preliminary responses seem to be very positive, that the inmates are feeling less anxiety, less violence, and so forth. But we're going to be doing some research actually trying to quantify that. And if that's the case, then there's an application then in places that just lack nature, toll booth operators. I mean, windowless offices of so many people who are working in cities right now, that what can we do to ameliorate and make that reconnection with forest, even if it's only through imagery, it seems to have some positive effect. And the Japanese actually have an emotional treatment they call Shinrin-yoku, which means tree shower. So if you're anxious, yeah, Doug, after a day of work, you know, Elaine there might say, you know, Doug, I think you need a Shinrin-yoku. So that involves just going out to any tree at all, putting up your arms, waiting there for a couple minutes, looking up to the tree. And after you feel a little calmer, you put your arms down, you come back to the studio, and you feel much more calm. So Shinrin-yoku is like the way to go.
You were married in a tree.
Yes.
And one of the things you write about is this idea of, which just sort of explores your connection to trees, obviously, but the idea of mindfulness,
mm-hmm.
is an important part of the book and this connection to trees. Would you talk a little bit about that, this idea of mindfulness, because this is obviously something you think a lot about.
Sure. So, you know, when I was talking about that triangle, that modified Maslow triangle, I see the peak of it, the apex of that that triangle is mindfulness. That is, if we are become aware and mindful that we need trees for all of these different, to meet our different needs of physical and security and play and time and spirituality, then if we actually do realize that and take that into our minds and our spirits, then we become mindful of trees, and then we might actually do something to protect them. So I see that as the apex of where we go as we learn about this very strong interconnectedness and intertwinedness that trees and humans have.
But you write about the fact that your own son, I'm not sure if this is still true, but when you wrote the book, he wasn't climbing trees like
right,
you were.
Right, right. I was very worried about that. You know, he was a typical 11, 12-year-old in our century. And so he'd be, instead of running out to the forest, and we have 5 acres of trees in our backyard and so forth. And I mean, when I was a girl, I ran outside and played in the trees. And, you know, there was Gus plunking away on his AIM and his computer games. And so I really worried that Gus would not grow up with the mindfulness that I did, the sense of connection to trees and to nature that I did. And I worried about that with Gus, and I worry about that with every young person who isn't connected, or every old person who isn't connected with nature. And I think in many ways, and this is something that the forestry conference is trying to sort of get a hold on, is that we realize with increasing urbanization that more than half of humans now live in cities, that this growing disconnect between understanding that, you know, this pencil right here, this comes from wood, that comes from a living tree that grew somewhere. And so let's remember that. Let's remember that the quality of our air, that the amount of oxygen that we have, that the carbon that they get sequestered, the medicines that might come up, those are connected to trees and to people as well. So if I feel like, you know, my work, when I think of the remaining decade of my career, I think my work is both about the collecting of knowledge of trees and forests so that I can better understand them. But it's also about the connecting of the importance of trees to other people of all kinds, religious people, slam poets, my son, your radio listeners, just to say, whoa, yeah, we have to remember that these silent, seemingly immobile creatures that share our planet are in fact fundamental. And if we can be mindful of that, we move closer to be able to sustain them. And I think that's what we need.
Nalini Nadkarni, author of the book Between Earth and Sky, Our Intimate Connections to Trees. Professor, thank you very much.
You're welcome. That was fun.
Thanks for being here. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show today was produced by Michael Shea. The program is produced also by, of course, Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.